Today on Tapestry, you're hearing a report from the conference Restorying Canada. It was organized by the Institute of Canadian and Aboriginal Studies at the University of Ottawa. Here's Margaret Atwood on utopias and dystopias and how they may not be as different as they seem.
How I met Leah is like this. I also kind of wish I'd met you before I wrote Year of the Flood, but it seems I never write things that don't already exist. So I wrote about a Christian come naturist come ecological group in the near future that lives on urban rooftops and cultivates gardens on them and also chooses hope and tries to reconcile science and ecology with scripture. Sound familiar? Yes. Yes. And because I had written this group, I was invited to be on a television show, and Leah and Marku appeared miraculously out from behind the woodwork. And there they were. You know, what I had written, it exists. You may wonder why I know all this stuff about Christianity. Well, I'm Canadian, and one of the things about Canada was that we didn't separate church and state the way Americans did. And I'm so old that I grew up at a time when there were two school systems, the Roman Catholic school system and the Protestant school system. The Protestant school system is now sort of morphed into a general public school system, but at that time it was still very Protestant. And so we had Bible readings and prayers all the time in school. In school. I tell this to Americans and they go, horrors. Yeah, they go, horrors. But we did. And it's very useful when you're studying English literature because you actually can't study English literature in its first five centuries without knowing something about the history of Christianity, various kinds of Christianity, and various kinds of debates and religious wars that went on. So partly the God's Gardeners came out of the fact that in North America there were, and probably still are, several different divisions in relationship to the natural world. And one of these divisions you might call the rapturists. And the rapturists think that God is going to fry everybody but them. And they're going to be up in the sky having a final time watching as the earth is destroyed. And God will then make a new one just for them. I wouldn't count on that because it seems to me that such a view is quite lacking in one of the central virtues that they are supposed to be living, and that would be love or charity, don't you think?
I think.
She thinks. she thinks that too. And then there's another school of thought that you might call the Dominionists, and they have misinterpreted the story of Noah, in my opinion. And they think that God gave man dominion, which is equated with permission to do whatever you want. And therefore, they think you can actually just destroy any old thing, and it doesn't matter because you've got dominion. And then the third group you could call the stewardship group. And the stewardship group, on the other hand, feels that, yes, you were entrusted with this, but your duty is not to destroy it and not to believe it's all going to be destroyed and everybody will sizzle and fry, except you. But your duty is to take care of it, to tend, as it were, the garden, however fallen that garden may appear to be. So I put the God's Gardeners in. I sometimes hear the view that the world's ills are due to religions. Some people have that view. I do not agree with that view because some atheist regimes have done a good job of oppressing and murdering people, too. It is true that Christianity has got some dark moments, and it's had some dark moments in Canada, dark moments of various kinds. But I don't think you can put that down to a religion. I think you can put that down to human beings behaving the way they unfortunately sometimes do, whatever religion or non-religion they may happen to have. The 19th century was an age in which really a lot of people wrote utopias. And utopias are books that present a world better than the one that the writer is living in. And some examples might be William Morris's News from Nowhere, W.H. Hudson's A Crystal Age, even Bulwer Lytton's The Coming Age. It's quite bad. But in it, I'll tell you a little story about it. In it, the hero is cave exploring, and he falls through a hole into an underground world, which is much better arranged than ours. And in this underground world, people draw on an energy source called Vril, V-R-I-L. And they're much wiser and smarter and more wonderful than we. And the women are bigger and more powerful than the men. And each person has got a set of inflatable wings. These aren't wings that grow on them. They're artificial wings powered by Vril. And if the bigger and more powerful women aren't nice to the men, they fly away. The men fly away. I think that's a metaphor for men's clubs of the 19th century. They weren't being nice to you at home. You could go to the club. Anyway, these Vrilians. And the story about the Vrilians then morphed. People start believing in them. And Vrilian societies sprang up. And in the First World War, they invented a cube made of condensed beef soup that was called Bovril, B-O-V-R-I-L, which means bovine vril. So the name got into Bovril. And then it got into Hitler, because Hitler too believed in the land of the Vril. And he sent some explorers to Norway, where this hole in the ground was supposed to be. And he wanted to get down into this underground world and draw upon the energy source. Well, you can see it would give you an edge if you could get hold of it. He was the wacko. So they were writing those kinds of books, and Bellamy's Looking Backward, which predicted credit cards, among other things. And then something happened in the 20th century, and people stopped writing utopias. They stopped a bit before the First World War. Jack London has got a dystopia that's before. But the First World War really put paid to utopias. The 19th century had written them because it seemed that things were getting better and better. So many discoveries and improvements had been made, and surely we could continue this on into the future, and things were going to get even better. And these utopias always had several things in common. One of them was that women's clothing in the utopia was always scantier than it was in the 19th century. Well, they got their wish. It is now. It is now. They're quite fixated on that, and also on sexual arrangements. For instance, in A Crystal Age, it turns out that everybody is sexually neutral, not more or less like ants, except for a doomed couple called the mother and the father, who have to sacrifice themselves for the rest of the community by having sex. Anyway, they stopped writing utopias and they started writing dystopias because they had seen the end of this era of progress. It had ended in tears with the First World War, and the Second World War really put paid to it. And one of the keys is that both the Russian Revolution and Nazi Germany were presented to the people as utopias. Make fill in the blank great again. So like that. That's today's version, by the way. So everything's going to be wonderful, but first we have to get rid of these people. So each one of these utopic visions, and it's true of the literary ones too, they've all got the part where you've got to get rid of those people. And I've described utopias and dystopias as a kind of yin-yang arrangement in which every dystopia contains within it a little utopia, and every utopia contains within it a little dystopia. And that dystopia usually takes the form of those people. You know, those people that you have to do something about before everything will be wonderful. And we have certainly seen a lot of examples of that in the 20th century. So my sci-fi writing pals and people asking them questions sometimes say, when are we going to get utopias again? You know, when is it going to be a thing that people do again? It's already started. People have written some which propose models for how we get out of this mess, you know, how we think ourselves, how we invent ourselves out of the crisis that we now are in. And I indulge in that a bit myself from time to time. But we're not quite there yet because the problems that we have are multiple. I've written, of course, two books that have got religions in them. One of them is The Handmaid's Tale, and one of them is the Mad Adam Trilogy. And the religion in the Mad Adam Trilogy is a benevolent one, but the one in The Handmaid's Tale is not a benevolent one. It is a totalitarian theocracy. And people sometimes say to me, well, does that mean you're anti-religion? And I say, no, it means that people have frequently used religion as a means of controlling societies and getting rid of people who don't agree with them. And that has just historically been true. And I think that just goes along with the human propensity to, once one has achieved power, to be very reluctant to let go of it. So I thought for Leah I would do two things. First of all, I would read from Adam 1's first sermon in Year of the Flood. So the God's gardeners have saints. They have saints that they name after ecological heroes. For instance, they've got, and heroines, they've got St. Farley Mowat of Wolves, and they have St. Diane Fossey, and they have St. Rachel Carson, and a whole bunch of others. I chose them from around the world. They're really quite a surprising number of them. Some of them are not only saints, but martyrs, because they got murdered for their ecological activities by powerful interests who wanted to keep on killing endangered species and clear-cutting forests, because it's lucrative, you know? It's always that. But they also have days dedicated to species and classes of animals and plants. So they have Predator Day, and they have Fish Day, basically. Fish, very important. So yes, the eye is on the sucker, to answer your question, and the nematode. But this is the Creation Day sermon. Of the creation and of the naming of the animals spoken by Adam 1. Dear friends, dear fellow creatures, dear fellow mammals, on Creation Day 5 years ago, the Eden Cliff rooftop garden of ours was a sizzling wasteland hemmed in by festering city slums and dens of wickedness, but now it has blossomed as the rose. By covering such barren rooftops with greenery, we are doing our small part in the redemption of God's creation from the decay and sterility that lies all around us, and feeding ourselves with unpolluted food into the bargain. Some would term our efforts futile, but if all were to follow our example, what a change would be wrought on our beloved planet. I think you just said that. Much hard work still lies before us, but fear not, my friends, for we shall move forward undaunted. I am glad we have all remembered our sun hats. Now let us turn our minds to our annual Creation Day devotion. The human words of God speak of the creation in terms that could be understood by the men of old. There is no talk of galaxies or genes, for such terms would have confused them greatly. But must we therefore take as scientific fact the story that the world was created in 6 days, thus making a nonsense of observable data? God cannot be held to the narrowness of literal and materialistic interpretations, nor measured by human measurements, for his days are eons, and 1,000 ages of our time are like an evening to him. Unlike some other religions, we have never felt it served a higher purpose to lie to children about geology. Remember the first sentences of those human words of God. The earth is without form and void, and then God speaks light into being. This is the moment that science terms the Big Bang, as if it were a sex orgy. Yet both accounts concur in their essence. Darkness, then in an instant, light. But surely the creation is ongoing, for are not new stars being formed at every moment? God's days are not consecutive, my friends. They run concurrently, the first with the third, the fourth with the sixth. As we are told, thou sendest forth thy spirit, they are created, and thou renewest the face of the earth. We are told that on the 5th day of God's creating activities, the waters brought forth creatures, and on the 6th day, the dry land was populated with animals and with plants and trees, and all were blessed and told to multiply, and finally Adam, that is to say mankind, was created. According to science, this is the same order in which the species did, in fact, appear on the planet, man last of all. Or more or less the same order, or close enough. What happens next? God brings the animals before man to see what he would call them. But why didn't God already know what names Adam would choose? The answer can only be that God has given Adam free will, and therefore Adam may do things that God himself cannot anticipate in advance. Think of that the next time you are tempted by meat-eating or material wealth. Even God may not always know what you are going to do next. God must have caused the animals to assemble by speaking to them directly. But what language did he use? It was not Hebrew, my friends. It was not Latin or Greek or English or French or Spanish or Arabic or Chinese, no. He called the animals in their own languages. To the reindeer, he spoke reindeer. To the spider, spider. To the elephant, he spoke elephant. To the flea, he spoke flea. To the centipede, he spoke centipede. And to the ant, ant. So must it have been. And for Adam himself, the names of the animals were the first words he spoke. The first moment of human language. In this cosmic instant, Adam claims his human soul. To name is, we hope, to greet, to draw another towards oneself. Let us imagine Adam calling out the names of the animals in fondness and joy, as if to say, "There you are, my dearest. Welcome." Adam's first act towards the animals was thus one of loving kindness and kinship, for man in his unfallen state was not yet a carnivore. The animals knew this and did not run away. So it must have been on that unrepeatable day, a peaceful gathering at which every living entity on the earth was embraced by man. How much have we lost, dear fellow mammals and fellow mortals? How much have we willfully destroyed? How much do we need to restore within ourselves? The time of the naming is not over, my friends. In his sight, we may still be living in the sixth day. As your meditation, imagine yourselves rocked in that sheltering moment. Stretch out your hand towards those gentle eyes that regard you with such trust, a trust that has not yet been violated by bloodshed and gluttony and pride and disdain. Say their names. Let us sing. Now, each of the sermons has a hymn that goes with it. And I wrote these originally in standard hymn metrics. My friend Orville Stober, who's a musician, got stuck into the manuscript before it was published, and he composed music for all of them. And I can even sing some of them. And I'm going to do a request. Leah has requested the Mole Song. The Mole Song takes place on the Festival of Underground Life Day. And since the things that live underground are mostly small, it is a children's festival. So this is We Praise the Tiny Perfect Moles, as sung by the Buds and Blooms Children's Choir. We praise the tiny perfect moles that garden underground. Boom, boom. The ant, the worm, the nematode, wherever they are found. Boom, boom. They live their whole lives in the dark, unseen by human sight. The earth is like the air to them, their day is like our night. They turn the soil and till it, they make the plants to thrive. The earth would be a desert if they were not alive. Boom, 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 boom. The little carrion beetles that seek unlikely places return our husks to elements and tidy up our spaces. And so for God's small creatures beneath the field and wood, let us today give joyful thanks, for God has found them good. Let us today give joyful thanks, for God has found them good.
Margaret Atwood in a keynote address at the Restoring Canada Conference, organized by the Institute of Canadian and Aboriginal Studies at the University of Ottawa.